From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Batman is back in movie theaters. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with the creator of the Batman character, Bob Kane. He started drawing the Caped Crusader in a 1939 comic. And speaking of superheroes, we'll feature an interview with Stan Lee, the creator of Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, The X-Men, and The Fantastic Four. Then we move from comics to cartoons and hear from Chuck Jones, the animation director behind classic Looney Tunes starring Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. Disney's new feature-length animation, Pocahontas, just opened. Film critic Stephen Schiff will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House is going to fight a compromised Republican budget plan. The proposal was announced yesterday by House and Senate leaders. It cuts the national deficit within 7 years and does this by scaling back several domestic programs like Medicare. The budget plan is just an outline and doesn't require the president's signature, but specific bills with changes in tax and spending laws will be sent to him for his approval or rejection. President Clinton calls the GOP budget plan a risk that could trigger a recession. The man accused of killing 2 people and wounding 5 others at 2 Boston-area women's clinics that perform abortions insists he's fit to stand trial, but his attorneys are arguing that he's not. From member station WBUR in Boston, Tovia Smith reports.
After months of tests, a state psychiatric hospital has agreed with prosecutors that 22-year-old John Salvi is competent to stand trial for the clinic shootings. Salvi himself says he wants a trial and the death penalty if he's convicted, but his attorney, J.W. Carney, today insisted his client is delusional, and he says 2 other psychiatrists who've examined Salvi say he's not fit to be tried.
It's not unusual that people who have any variety of mental illness do not recognize that fact and do not accept that fact.
Carney wants a special attorney appointed to represent Salvi on the issue of competency, which will be argued in court next month. That attorney, Carney says, would not be bound to follow the wishes of a client he believes to be delusional. For National Public Radio, this is Tovia Smith in Boston.
National Basketball Association owners have approved a new collective bargaining agreement with the players, but the union rank and file is balking at the arrangement. Evan Weiner has more from New York.
As far as NBA Commissioner David Stern is concerned, he has a 6-year labor agreement with his players. As far as members of the Players Association are concerned, there is no agreement and there may not be a Players Association. Daniel Silverman, the New York Regional Director of the National Labor Relations Board, has scheduled a hearing on a petition filed by 17 players, including Michael Jordan, seeking to decertify the National Basketball Players Association as the collective bargaining representative of NBA players on July 5th. The players and their agents don't like the new agreement, and they are trying to stop that agreement by contending union negotiator Simon Gordine and the union's executive board no longer represent them. For National Public Radio, I'm Evan Weiner in New York.
A Florida jury has convicted a second Miami man of murdering a German tourist more than 2 years ago. Anthony Williams has been found guilty of first-degree murder and robbery in the death of Barbara Meller Jensen. Her slaying caused consternation in the Florida tourism industry. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen more than 8 points. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Parts of central and southwest Virginia are under flood warnings. 2 days of rain forced rivers and streams over their banks. The flooding has claimed at least 1 life and closed many roads. Rick Mattioni of member station WVTF in Roanoke reports.
A 70-year-old dam southwest of Lynchburg burst last night, killing a rescue worker and sweeping cars into a nearby creek. Rescue workers were on a flooded bridge looking for people in trapped cars when the dam gave way, sweeping a volunteer firefighter, several cars, and a rescue boat into Buffalo Creek. Today, a 5-mile section of U.S. Route 460 remains closed. Several state highways and smaller roads are also closed because of flooding and mudslides. The Weather Service says 8 inches of rain fell in the Lynchburg area between Wednesday night and early today. An area west of Lynchburg recorded almost 10 inches of rain during the same period. Reporting for National Public Radio, I'm Rick Mattioni in Roanoke, Virginia.
Chechen and Russian negotiators have agreed to extend a ceasefire. A truce declared earlier this week expires at midnight local time. Both sides accuse the other of violating it. Peace talks started Monday after Chechen rebels stormed a small city in southern Russia. They seized some 2,000 captives. The captives were released. The gunmen returned to Chechnya and escaped into the hills. They first won some Russian concessions, including the resumption of peace talks. A U.S. and Russian commission has released a report on U.S. prisoners in Vietnam. The document says investigators have found no credible evidence that prisoners of war in Vietnam were ever taken to the Soviet Union for interrogation. But the commission did find during the Korean War, Soviet security services had, quote, concrete instructions to actively support the interrogation of American POWs. Reports from Vietnam to Soviet intelligence on U.S. prisoners are still being checked. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Batman! Robin!
That's right. We're after some jewel thieves, but our car's been disabled. May we use yours?
Sure, hop in.
No, I meant we'll take yours and you stay here with ours. There might be trouble.
Well, trouble don't bother me none. But if that's the way you feel about it, take her and welcome.
Pretty wooden for superheroes, huh? Apparently, one of Batman's special gifts is the ability to survive even the clunkiest portrayal, like the one we just heard from a 1949 movie serial. Right now, Batman Forever is triumphing at the box office. My guest, Bob Kane, is the creator of the Batman character and was a consultant for the new film. Over the years, he's watched the Caped Crusaders' continuing adventures with alternate pride and horror. Kane created Batman in 1939 and continued drawing him for DC Comics until 1966, the year the Batman TV series debuted. When he gave up drawing Batman comics, Kane started painting Batman on canvas. Kane created Batman a year after the debut of Superman comics. In 1990, he told me that the idea of creating a new superhero was initiated by his editor at DC Comics.
Well, I was having lunch with the editor that time, Vincent Sullivan, and he said he was looking for another superhero. Actually, Superman was created in 1938, and the period when I spoke to Vincent Sullivan was 1939. It was about a year later. And prior to that, I was doing fill-in cartoons for DC Comics and making maybe $20, $25 a week. And I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, Siegel and Shuster. He said they were making $800 a week apiece. Now, in 1938, that was comparable to about $5,000 a week today. And I was kind of a poor kid from the Bronx looking to, you know, get wealthy and famous. So I said, hey, for that kind of money, I could create a superhero. So I went home that weekend, and I drew upon some of my early influences. And as I recalled, I was 18 at the time, but when I was 13 years old, I saw a book by Leonardo da Vinci, a book of inventions. And he had one book with a flying machine, an ornithopter, and it was a man on a sled with huge bat wings. And even Leonardo had a quote on that particular invention. It was the first man in flight, the first glider, actually. And the quote was, your bird shall have no other model but that of a bat. And it kind of initiated an idea to me about a Batman. And that was when I was 13 years old. So that weekend, I drew upon that influence. And there were movies I used to be influenced by as a kid, one called The Mark of Zorro, The Dual Identity with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And that gave me my second influence. During the day, he was a board count in the Southern California in the 1880s, and at night he became a crusader fighting against the injustices of the dictatorship at that time.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers? I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. And I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, you said that his look, Batman's look, was inspired in part by the Zorro movie that you liked so much. Now, you were, when you were young, in a gang called the Crusading Zorros, and you used to wear hooded masks. What was the connection between the Crusading Zorros that you were a member of as a kid in the Bronx and the Batman look?
Well, to begin with, we wore Zorro wore a mask at night to hide his identity, so that the desperados that he would apprehend would know him during the day if they saw him. Therefore, they couldn't retaliate. And when I was a kid and living in the Bronx, we had these clubs, that we would all band together to protect ourselves against rival gangs in other neighborhoods. It was pretty tough in the Bronx at that time. And so we wore Zorro masks to hide our identities when we would raid one of the rivals' clubs and kind of beat up on them. And therefore, if they wanted to retaliate, Terry, they wouldn't know who to apprehend because we wore the masks of Zorro. It was a dual identity, so to speak.
Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not-Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted it to sound... I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and in my daydreams. I felt, instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night, because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper of the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Actually, it's called the union suit character, and for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work, and mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the batarang, and so forth. I used the entire bat mystique to create my bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more misterioso. Yeah, somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
You drew Batman for DC Comics. You stayed with that house. What are some of the pros and cons of doing a comic for a comic book house like that? Who owns the rights to the characters, for instance?
Unfortunately, that's that's part of the negative part of the business, is that when you're young, you sell away your copyrights, and actually it's that happens with most of the cartoonists, and they own the character at that time, I couldn't take it elsewhere. And actually, I was making very good money. And in 1940, 41, I was making practically $1,000 a week. And so you're not about to leave. And $1,000 a week in 1940 was comparable to about $5,000, $6,000 today a week. And so being that they owned the copyright, I did the best I could at the time by compromising and getting a good piece of the action and a perpetuity contract. So therefore, I did rather well compared to some artists who sold it away and didn't get very much out of it.
Have you owned a piece of the merchandising over the years?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
I
do rather well.
I'll bet, yeah.
I mean, all things being equal, I'd love to own it, and I would have done 1,000% better, but I didn't do badly the way it turned out, and life is a compromise. If it weren't for the publisher, I never would have been where I am today. So you know, one hand washes the other.
How did the comic book code affect you in 1954? And the code restricted content matter of the comics. And this was a period
For a while, what happened was whenever there's a successful industry, you generally have some sleazy fly-by-nights that want to cash in on it and on the coattails of anything famous. And so a bunch of these fly-by-night publishers came out with some really schlocky, if I could use that word, books that depicted sex that we never had, blatant sex, you might say, violence, cutting heads off with the blood oozing out, and they had bad grammar and illicit wordage and so forth. And so a lot of the whole industry suffered along the way with its sleazy books, because a lot of mothers stopped their children from reading comic books in general, including the DC line and other books of our good caliber. So what happened is a code was set up, like in the early days of the motion picture industry, they had the Hays Office, which was a code of ethics of what you could do or what you could show or not show on the screen. If there was too much sex and violence, they cut down on that. I think a censorship is good to a degree, but if you have too much censorship, you take away the freedom of the press and the writer and the artist and so forth.
Were your freedoms restricted? Were there things that you wanted to do and couldn't do when the code was put into practice?
Oh, no. No, our books were never... We censored our own books, so we weren't under the fire of the of the anti-comic book people and the parents' associations and so forth. No, our books were always clean, so we had nothing to worry about. We just had to sit tight, and then we had a code which the good comic book publishers created, and which had to have every drawing had to have a stamp of approval by the Comics Code of America, and then this knocked out the sleazy comic books only because they couldn't get the code of approval, therefore they couldn't get any distribution, so they stopped publishing, and they only interfered maybe a year or two, and then they all died out, and we went on our merry way publishing clean comic books as they are and have been all through the years.
There are still Batman comics now, yes?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have ghost artists. In fact, the new breed of Batman comics are graphic novels, and they're done with hardcovers. Some of them are $30 a book. Some are $25 a book, and they're done on beautiful paper. There's been a whole evolution since the days I created Batman for 10 cents a comic book. Now, Batman number one that I don't own, the 1939 book, the May issue of Detective Comics, has started in 6 pages, now sells for $50,000. There are only about 12 in the country, and I don't have one of them. I had them 1 to 100, but my first wife threw them all out when I got divorced. But anyway, one day I'll get number one back, I guess.
Bob Kane created the character Batman. Our interview was recorded in 1990. More about superheroes when we continue this archive edition after a short break. This is Fresh Air. When you talk about comic book superheroes, you have to talk about Stan Lee. He co-created Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men, the Silver Surfer, the Invincible Iron Man, and Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. Stan Lee joined Marvel Comics over 50 years ago. He's been Marvel's head writer, art director, and publisher. Now he oversees the adaptation of Marvel characters into films and television. He's currently co-executive producer of the animated Spider-Man and X-Men series on the Fox Children's Network. In 1991, Stan Lee told me how he came up with one of his most famous superheroes, Spider-Man.
Before, I came up with the name Spider-Man. I had decided I wanted a superhero who could crawl on walls, stick to the ceiling, and so forth. And I said, gee, that's a real insect power. What'll I call him? And my first thought was Insect Man, and that just didn't do it for me at all. And then I thought, well, let's see, there's Mosquito Man. That really had no appeal at all. And I went down a whole list, and when I got to Spider-Man, I mean, it was like a bell rang, a light went off above my head. Spider-Man was it. And when I put the amazing in front of it, I knew we were home free.
What makes a superhero a Stan Lee superhero? What are some of the qualities?
Well, it has to be magnificently written. The creation has to be a work of genius. But to be serious, the one thing that I've tried to do is give them the most human and realistic qualities possible. Now, it may sound like a contradiction in terms, because our superheroes are fantasy characters with superpowers that no human being possesses, and yet I try to be realistic about it. But the basic idea is you take one fantastic element, like, well, with a Hulk, like somebody who's got the strength of 50 men and green skin, and then you say, suppose such a character really existed. What would his life be like in the real world? Where would he live? What would he wear? Who would he relate to? And so forth. And having asked the reader to suspend disbelief in the area of the character's superpower, you then try to make everything else as realistic as you can.
How did the superheroes that you created compare to the kinds of heroes in comics when you started working at Marvel back when you were a teenager?
Well, when I started working for the comics, all the heroes were really cut out of the same mold. They were tall and handsome and strong and noble, and as far as their dialogue went, I felt insufferably dull.
Give me an example of a type of writing you thought was really square and dull.
Okay. I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that you're walking down the street and you see a monster coming toward you. And this monster is 12 feet tall with purple skin, four arms, a tail, and he's breathing fire and he's got two heads. And if in those days, if Superman or Batman or one of our own characters, Captain America or anybody, any typical superhero, had seen this monster walking down the street in one of the stories, I think the dialogue would have gone something like this. Oh, a creature from another world. I'd better capture him before he destroys the city. Well, I would like to feel that in one of our comic books, one of our heroes, such as Spider-Man, might say, who's the nut in the Halloween costume? I wonder what he's advertising. And it was just that shade of difference. I tried to do dialogue that represented the way real flesh and blood, three-dimensional people would talk and would react to things. And it came across as satire. But I wasn't trying to write humor. I was trying to be realistic. So I must be funnier than I thought.
Now, what about deciding on the alliterative sounds that you would use when somebody got hit?
Oh, I loved sounds. And again, I think what it is, I've always hated cliches. As you can imagine, formally in the comics, if somebody was hit or if there was a sound effect of a loud noise, the sound effect would be pow or bam or sock or bop. Something of that sort. So I tried to make up crazy sound effects that would at least be original. I would have PFZZAKT, which I cannot pronounce, but that might be the sound of a bullet going through a wall or something. One of my all-time favorite sound effects was BTKOOM, and it was spelled BTKOOOM with three O's. And then I put a little asterisk at the end of the word with a note on the bottom of the panel saying the third O, of course, is silent. And so I had fun with the sound effects. As far as the alliterative names, most of our characters had alliterative names. There was Peter Parker and Bruce Banner and Reed Richards. And I had a very pragmatic reason for doing that. I have a terrible memory, always did. And it was difficult for me to remember the names of my characters. But by having the same first letter for a character, if I could remember the Peter, it gave me a clue that the last name also began with P, and I would eventually remember it was Parker, you see. So it made it easier for me to remember the names by giving them the same first letter.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but why do superheroes so often wear tights?
I don't know. I think it is simply precedent. It started out that way. The first books, and I wasn't around at that time, had them that way. The funny thing is, when I did our first superhero book, The Fantastic Four, in an effort to avoid the cliché, I told the artist, I don't want costumes on these guys. I just want them to wear clothes. So they didn't have skin-tight costumes. We sent the book out. It was published. We received a lot of fan mail. The kids said they loved it. We knew we had a winner, and we were on our way now. But virtually every letter said, we think it's the greatest book. We'll buy it forever. We love it. Turn out more. But if you don't give them colorful costumes, we won't buy the next issue. And I do not know. I think you'd have to be a psychologist or a sociologist or something and do an intensive study. But there, for some reason, unless these characters are garbed in some sort of outlandish outfit, the readers don't seem to accept that. Even the Hulk. I had no great reason for giving him green skin, except I knew if he had normal colored skin, we probably wouldn't sell as many books. There has to be something colorful about the way they look, visually.
Are you a colorful dresser yourself?
No, I'm the most conservative guy you'll ever see. I wear jeans a lot, but I don't know that that's very colorful.
What about physically? Do you have any special physical strengths?
Oh, I'm incredibly powerful. Right. I've got these broad shoulders and bulging, but no, I'm kind of tall and skinny, and nobody would ever mistake me for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I want to get back to what you were saying before, that you couldn't create a character without a colorful costume because the readers swore they'd never read it, no matter how much they love the character.
That's right. I could create it, but it's just I don't think we would have sold it.
Yeah, right, right. Well, now, with women superheroes, I bet the equivalent is, no matter how wonderful the character, you have to give her a large bosom or else they won't buy it.
Well, I guess you're right, but I don't know that it's anything sexist as much as symbolic. For example, you'll find that most of the heroes, as I say, they have broad shoulders and big biceps, and, you know, they're all sort of Schwarzeneggers, and most of the women are Marilyn Monroes, and I think it's just that the artists try to draw idealized men and women. And I guess that's the way most people idealize people.
Stan Lee, recorded in 1991. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Chuck Jones, who directed such cartoon stars as Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, and Porky Pig, and created the characters Pepe Le Pew, Wile E. Coyote, and The Roadrunner. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Disney's new animated feature, Pocahontas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Democrats are criticizing a compromise Republican outline for cutting the deficit in 7 years. They say it's too close to House Republican plans to create big tax breaks and trim federal programs. President Clinton, who's in Little Rock, Arkansas, telephoned 5 Democratic governors who support his alternative plan to balance the budget in 10 years. He said the GOP plan would hurt states.
I am glad that both the president and the majority in Congress are committed to a balanced budget, and I believe most of the Democrats in Congress are as well, but I still disagree fundamentally with the way in which they propose to balance the budget, and I think it will complicate your lives as governors considerably.
House and Senate Republican leaders announced agreement late yesterday on their budget outline. Their blueprint chiefly cuts spending for Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare. The budget outline maps tax and spending plans. It doesn't finalize them, so it doesn't require the president's signature. U.S. trade negotiators say it's all or nothing in automobile trade talks with Japan. A U.S. official says Washington won't take a partial settlement of the long dispute. Japanese officials have said they're willing to accept such a resolution as a small step. Both sides are in the second and final day of talks to resolve their trade dispute. An investigator from the New York City Public Schools has issued a report alleging what many students have long suspected. Some food served for school lunch is unsuitable. Dick Hinchliff of member station WNYC reports.
The investigation concluded that the food is not just bad tasting, but often tainted or even rancid. During a 15-month study, the Special Commissioner of School Investigations, Edward Stancic, says he found that food was often stored well beyond its recommended shelf life. And students' complaints that food smelled or tasted bad or appeared to have been eaten by rodents were ignored. In one case, Stancic says 1,500 whole turkeys were shipped to the schools after turkey burgers made from the lot were spoiled. The report cites more than 1,000 cases of suspected food poisoning dating back to 1991. Stancic claims the executive director of food services shipped the bad food to avoid criticism for throwing it away at a cost of millions of dollars. The director denies the charge. He and 2 assistants have been temporarily relieved of their duties while the school's chancellor considers final action. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The government says orders for durable goods rose in May for the first time in 4 months. The Commerce Department says orders for products expected to last for 3 years or more increased 2.5% last month. The report shows some strength in the U.S. economy, which some analysts say is in a slowdown. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 4 points to end the day at 4,585. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR. A new study of the 1994 elections reveals that Republican candidates got the majority of votes cast nationally. This ends nearly half a century of Democratic dominance. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
The report from the Center for the Study of the American Electorate in Washington found that 19% of the votes cast for Congress in the last election went to Republicans, exceeding the 16% going to Democrats for the first time since 1946. Republican gains were most striking in the South, where they won a majority of House seats for the first time since the 19th century. The study found that Republicans also made inroads in every other region of the country. About the only good news for Democrats were slight increases for them in the Mid-Atlantic states and the far west. Curtis Gans, the center's director, said the Republican dominance appeared to be a continuation of a long-term trend. But he cautioned the GOP should not take the gains for granted. The number of registered Republicans, Democrats too, declined in 1994, while the number of voters rejecting both parties was up. I'm Philip Davis in Washington.
The search is on for a new nominee for Surgeon General, but White House spokesman Mike McCurry says finding a replacement for Dr. Henry Foster may not be easy, especially if senators use the Right to Life platform as a litmus test. President Clinton says when Republicans blocked a final vote on Foster's nomination yesterday, they failed a basic test of fairness. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and Republican Senator Phil Graham, both presidential contenders, led the fight against Foster. The White House has shelved a Pentagon plan to conduct underground nuclear tests. Arms control advocates argue the resumption of the testing would undermine a global test ban treaty that President Clinton supports. One administration official says the plan is quashed for now. National Security Advisor Anthony Lake canceled a high-level meeting set for today to talk about the merits of the testing. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A little later, we'll feature a review of the new animated film Pocahontas. First, the story behind some cartoon superstars. Animation director Chuck Jones created many now classic Warner Brothers Looney Tunes, featuring Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. He created the characters Pepe Le Pew, Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Jones worked at Warner Brothers from 1933 until the studio closed down its cartoon division in 1963. Then he formed his own production company and created primetime TV specials. His company now makes 6-minute cartoons for theaters to show before the feature presentation. I spoke with Chuck Jones in 1989 after the publication of his autobiography, Chuck Amuck. The title was borrowed from Duck Amuck, Jones's cartoon about cartooning. In it, Daffy Duck finds himself at the mercy of a fickle cartoonist. Daffy opens the cartoon as a brave musketeer, but the cartoonist keeps changing the scenery on him to the most inappropriate settings, a farm, the Arctic, Hawaii. The cartoonist eventually erases not only the background, but Daffy himself.
Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds? Dashing through the snow, through the fields we go, laughing all the way. Farewell to thee, farewell to thee. The wind will carry back our sad refrain. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon. And that in animated cartoons, they have scenery. And in all the years I... All right, wise guy, where am I?
Chuck Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. You changed a lot of the characters who you worked with over the years.
Uh-huh.
And can you describe, when you first started directing Daffy Duck, who was always my favorite, when you started directing Daffy Duck, what was he like? And then maybe you could tell us a little bit of the character changes that you brought to the
It's a little difficult to isolate them exactly as to what I contributed, but I all the characters I felt were part of me, particularly Daffy and the Coyote, because they made the kind of mistakes that most of us make, only multiplied a bit. But Daffy was an interesting character, I think, because he would rush in and fear to tread at the same time. And he also could be fawning and overbearing at the same time. And I think that happens with very many of us when we, sometimes in the reverse, when we go in to talk to the boss and ask for a raise, we're overbearing. When we get inside, we're fawning. But Daffy is both at the same time. At the beginning, he was just crazy, as was Bugs, even in the first great, Wild Hare that Tex Avery directed. The character was really kind of mad, more like Harpo Marx, perhaps. And I was never comfortable with a character unless I could understand him, and I can't understand crazy people. So I always try to sort of pasteurize my characters to find out who they are. The who is the whole point about character animation is not what. It isn't what a character looks like or indeed how it's drawn.
You sound like a method animator.
Well, I guess so. I don't think that I could do it unless I cared about the characters.
In your cartoon, Duck Amuck, why did you choose Daffy Duck as the character that was going to be at the whim of the cartoonist?
Well, I tried it later with Bugs Bunny and didn't work. Fortunately, I did Duck Amuck first, then I did one called Rabbit Rampage. And he also had the same problem, and the person in this case turned out to be Elmer Fudd that was moving him around. But it didn't work because that's not the kind of person that Bugs is. Bugs is a comic hero, you see, as compared with a comic wimp, which would go back to all the great comedians, starting with Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all the rest of them. They were, they're all kind of semi-losers, aren't they? They're more like us. And
But I was like Daffy because he would continue beyond where I would stop simply because I'd be afraid of what the community would think of me. Daffy continues, so... But when I was working with him, all I had to do was reach down inside of me and bring the Daffy up to the surface and spread it out and take a look at it and see what would I do if I had Daffy Duck's courage.
You told us a little bit about how you changed Daffy Duck and how you drew him a little differently, different characteristics you gave him. What about Bugs Bunny? What are some of the changes you brought to Bugs's life?
Well, I think that one of the nice things about there were three units there. After 1946, all the films that Warner now owns were directed by Fritz Feeling or Bob McKimson or me. Bob Clamp had left in 46 and Tex around 44. And so we had these wonderful sessions. When I would get an idea for a film, or my writer and I would get an idea for a film, we'd call in the other directors and writers, and we'd sit down and have this session, which we called a yes session, which meant for 2 hours nobody could say anything negative. If you couldn't contribute to the idea, your job was to shut up. But usually, the ideas were pretty good when they came in. The result of this was that we were all involved with each other's picture, although each director had absolute control of what went into his own pictures. But there was no internecine warfare. We liked each other. We wanted each other to succeed. But if I gave a great gag to Fritz Freeling and he used it, and it appeared on the screen and got an enormous laugh. Naturally, I wanted to go out and throw up, but because that's human nature, that's Daffy Duck in me.
All the great characters of the Warner Brothers cartoons are all animals. They're animals with the traits of people, but they're not people. They're ducks and rabbits and skunks. What are some of the advantages of using animals instead of people for the cartoons?
Well, we had ample precedents to go on. I mean, going back to Aesop's Fables and Kipling, and even Mark Twain did several things about animals, and of course Beatrix Potter and so many others. But the main thing is that it's easier to humanize animals than it is to humanize humans. And it's as you know from seeing Snow White and the Poor Princes and all the Disney films, it's very difficult to animate human beings. And when we did animate them, they didn't look very much like human beings. I mean, Elmer Fudd doesn't look any more like a human being than Bugs Bunny looks like a rabbit. Bugs is obviously not a rabbit. Rabbits look more like, and the average rabbit looks very much more like a pillow than anything else. However, I think that taking a rabbit and making him as heroic as Bugs Bunny is a lot more easy than it is to take a human being and make him like Bugs, with Bugs's characteristics.
You always believe that in a cartoon world that you have to create certain rules of the universe, and the characters always have to live within those rules. Give us an example through, say, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, because you created those characters.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the universe that you created them in.
Well, there are several things that happen when in all comedy. The more you channelize, the more you narrow your character down, the better it gets. For some reason, take Charlie Chaplin, when he once got that little costume, look how much he was restricted in what he could do. He could only be the little tramp, but he could be the little tramp and he also limited the little tramp in pretty much into living in a city. Well, we felt that when we got the Roadrunner and Coyote going, it was evident that they both lived in the southwestern American desert. And so you immediately say to yourself, that's where they live, that's where they got to live. And the fact that the Roadrunner is a Roadrunner means that he should stay on the road. And there were a number of other rules about that the Roadrunner can never harm the coyote. The coyote can only harm himself by buying those unfortunate things he gets from the Acme Corporation. So on. So that's what we... And the more rules you apply, you never hear any other sound except the beep beep, and I found that going back then to Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny is such a powerful character, and he's a comic hero rather than a loser. He's such a powerful character that he could become a terrible bully. So we always started Bugs in every picture. We started him in a natural rabbit environment, minding his own business. A quiet living rabbit, something like Rex Harrison, perhaps, before he got involved with My Fair Ladies. And then someone comes along and tries to deprive him of his foot or his life or his, you know, or sending him up in a rocket or something. And then he has to fight back, you see. And when once engaged in the war, then he's happily engaged. But without that, he would just be a bully. And there were some characters like Heckle and Jekyll and Woody Woodpecker at some time seemed to go out and just heckle people for no particular reason. Bugs never did that. And this is vital and necessary if you wanted the character to be believable and for people to care about him.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Chuck Jones. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is animation director Chuck Jones, who directed many now classic Looney Tunes and created the characters Pepe Le Pew, the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote.
Now, I grew up on the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the older I'd get, the more jokes I'd get. But I never realized I was missing anything when I was young, you know, because I always liked them. And now as an adult, I see things that I didn't see when I thought I was getting all the jokes when I was an older kid. Did anyone at Warner Brothers ever give you an argument that certain things there would go over the head of the heads of the audience?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we didn't pay attention to them. We always had going battles on with our producers. So they would issue edicts like, don't make any pictures about bullfights. Bullfights aren't funny. Well, that immediately would say, well, gee, obviously the guy has always been wrong. So we made a picture about a bullfight and it turned out fine. No, we had very little problem. Fortunately, our producers were not very bright.
Well, who did you have to answer to?
Nobody. Because our pictures went out with the Warner Brothers features, and they were always played in theaters. And we really didn't know anything about how they were received until eventually we would get word from the exhibitor, who, after all, was the one who could judge his audience's response. So, no, we only made them for ourselves. We never made them for anybody else. We couldn't preview, and we weren't allowed to. There were no such things as these idiotic demographics and Nielsen ratings and stuff. And the first critic hadn't been born, so we just tried to amuse one another, and it seemed to work.
I remember once seeing a short film that was a combination of kind of pornographic cartoons that some of the Disney animators drew in their off hours.
Yeah.
And it ended up getting into circulation. Did you guys ever do anything like
sure.
that at Warner Brothers? Yeah?
Yeah, everybody did that. In fact, sometimes when in a Pepe Le Pew picture, I would I'd put a little salacious one frame at 1/24th of a second. And I'd actually put it in the picture. And then I'd ask the office manager to come in. I said, there's a little glitch here. There's starting to hop at this point. I don't know what it, I can't figure out what it is. Then I'd bring it to a stop in the moviola, and, you know, that thing when you look through, and there it would be, you know. Well, I knew nobody could ever see it because it was 1/24th of a second. But then he would go into shock, you know. And we always had a frame to replace it just in case, but I enjoyed doing that. It kind of put him in his place.
So did he make you take that out, or did those frames stay?
No. I told him it was too late. It would cost money to take it out, and nobody would ever see it. But I had already inserted it. It wasn't there anyway. But I did it to see if I couldn't put him into, as we used to say, reduce him to moccasins.
Were any of your scenes or any of your language ever censored?
No, that was left to the brilliant people at the networks, and they take out things and make the whole thing incomprehensible.
Did that happen a lot, that you felt your cartoons were butchered when they got on TV?
Oh, yes, they were, both at CBS and ABC, to name a few of the guilty ones. What's curious to me is that they feel it was necessary to chew up those cartoons, but Nickelodeon, which is a program that's supposedly designed for children, sees no need to do that.
Well, how did the networks edit the cartoons? What kinds of material would they find offensive?
Oh, practically everything. I, you know, in the Bugs Bunny and Rabbit Season, Duck Season things, they would take out every shot in which somebody, you know, those shots where Daffy's bill would be shot around. They'd show him getting ready to shoot, then they'd cut out the part of the shooting, and then they'd come back, and the poor child hadn't the remotest idea what happened.
Because they thought that it was too violent?
Yeah. You couldn't even hit somebody with a pie, for God's sake.
But when I was growing up in the 50s, I think...
No, they weren't.
They were on, fully.
Yes, they were. They didn't do all that idiotic stuff. Listen, to me, a person who bears the title of program practices means censorship, and it are people that are too fat to run and too cowardly to fight.
I'd imagine that the cartoons that had gotten the most objections because of the violence with the Roadrunner cartoons, since they're all chase.
Well, that's absurd, though, because the Roadrunner... In the coyote, the Roadrunner never harmed the coyote. The coyote was only a victim of his own ineptitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that there was any violence involved there is ridiculous.
Did you ever think of yourself as doing a pop kind of surrealism?
I did some, they tell me. But I never did anything, you know, by sitting down and saying, I'm doing this for a reason.
Right.
What I was trying to do was to develop the characters that I understood and to have fun doing it. That was the whole secret of Warner Brothers cartoons, is a bunch of people happened to come together from varied walks of life, all of whom were enormously interested in making films that were fun to do.
Animation director Chuck Jones, recorded in 1989. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what's the budget news on Capitol Hill?
Hi, Terry. Republicans in Congress have now compromised on a federal budget proposal. The intention is to balance the budget by 2002 and then to apply a $245 billion tax cut. Now it's the Democrats' turn to respond. Other stories, Chris Arnold from KQED reporting on the announced closing of two military bases in California. David Wellner reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. There's an election coming up there this weekend. Julie McCarthy on the memories of World War II among the islanders of Okinawa. Ira Glass has his final report at the year's end of Washington Irving Elementary School in Chicago. And Bob Mondello on the film Smoke.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The latest Disney animation movie, Pocahontas, had the most spectacular premiere ever. It was shown on four giant screens in Central Park to over 100,000 people. But now it's opening in a theater near you, and it's time to ask, is it any good? Film critic Stephen Schiff has some answers.
I liked Pocahontas, which is strange, really, because it's got everything I usually hate in a movie. The characters are as bland and generic as the people in a Disease of the Week picture on TV. The hero, Captain John Smith, is a blonde cartoon hunkoid, who seems mostly to be an imitation of other blonde cartoon hunkoids. The villain, Governor Ratcliffe, is fat and supercilious, with a hoity-toity British accent and a bad mustache. He, too, seems a pallid imitation of other more persuasive villains. The plot comes straight out of history, but gets everything spectacularly wrong. Yes, the English settlers came to the New World looking for wealth, and yes, they soon found themselves at odds with the Indians. But Pocahontas never had a West Side Story-style love affair with Captain John Smith, as she does here. And besides, she was only 12 years old, which this movie's Pocahontas decidedly is not. In fact, Disney's Pocahontas is a dead ringer for Tia Carrere, who played the rock babe pursued by Wayne in Wayne's World. She's as sexy as anyone who's been drawn without a nose can be. Imagine Jessica Rabbit in Buckskins, and you begin to get the picture. Oh, and the movie has a habit that usually drives me up the wall. It lectures. Take, for instance, this song, Colors of the Wind, which Pocahontas, using the pizzazzy Broadway voice of Judy Kuhn, sings to John Smith.
You think you own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature. has a life, has a spirit, has a name. You think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you'll learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue corn moon? Or asked the grinning bobcat why he grinned? Can you sing with all the voices of the mountain? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind?
Got the message? Ordinarily, I would say save the preaching for Sunday school. But strangely, I find Pocahontas's brand of PC completely inoffensive. I think that's because, unlike the other recent Disney animation blockbusters, this one doesn't come across as a fairy tale, or in fact as any sort of tale at all. Pocahontas is a parable. Its purpose isn't to transport us to a fantastical new world, but to teach a simple lesson. And since that's manifestly clear from the beginning, and since everything in the movie works in that direction, the preaching never gets in the way of anything else. There isn't anything else. That may make Pocahontas sound a bit dull. And the truth is, it's not as funny or as imaginative as most of the other recent Disney spectaculars. But Pocahontas is all of a piece. The romance in it is swoony and compelling. The drawing is, as always, meticulous. The raccoon and hummingbird that provide comic relief do so gently and then disappear. And the lively voice of Mel Gibson saves John Smith from being the pale, heroic slab he might have been. In short, kids will love Pocahontas slightly less than they loved the last few Disney animations, but they'll love it all the same. And adults being dragged to see it will genuinely enjoy it the first two or three times. After that, they can always console themselves with the fact that, after all, it's only an hour and 10 minutes long.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Jill Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Plume Paperbacks, publisher of A Whole New Life, An Illness and a Healing by Reynolds Price. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Elaine Pagels. She wrote the award-winning book, The Gnostic Gospels, based on her interpretations of documents written during the first 300 years after the death of Christ. Her new book, The Origin of Satan, is about how Jews and Christians deal with forces of evil. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.